Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
First of all, I want to welcome everyone to the Tattered Cover Bookstore, and thanks for coming out this evening and supporting your local and independent businesses, because it really does make a difference in our community. And just real quick, I just want to briefly just introduce tonight's author. I've been looking through the books myself, and it's been really fun. I always like the beginning of a new mystery series where you're trying to figure out the characters, and this one has a lot that I like about it. Maybe it's that time when I was reading Shogun back in the day that I fell in love with at least feudal Japan.
We all did.
Different reasons. Sure, but I mean, I fell in love with feudal Japan and I worked my way through the book. And I just wanted to say, I just love that period of time. And it's just been neat kind of being able to revisit it with tonight's authors with the book. So what people will come to expect from this book would be, there's basically a mystery that involves a lot of things. First, on the personal level, but it seems like they just slowly grow, and then just start involving more and more in the political and cultural environment as well. And it's really great how tonight's author kind of clearly turned a love of fiction, and then also all things Asian, especially all things Japanese, and just created a great series set in this particular time. So I just, without further ado, I just want to go ahead and welcome Susan Spahn.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Well, thank you for coming out tonight and supporting me, and I appreciate that. And this is, as he mentioned, the second book in the Shinobi Mystery Series. The title is Blade of the Samurai, the first novel, Claws of the Cat, released last year, and the third novel, Flask of the Drunken Master, will release in July of 2015. And in the first novel, which you don't have to read in order to read Blade, although it helps if you like the character development of a series. The first novel involves ninja or shinobi Hiro Hattori and his Portuguese Jesuit sidekick, Father Mateo, who must solve the murder of a samurai who's been murdered in a tea house, what we would today call a geisha house. And that takes place in 1564 during the time of the shoguns, which is, in fact, very similar to the era in James Clavell's Shogun, although not exactly the same time period, somewhat later. And Blade of the Samurai picks up the action a year later. It is June of 1565. The political situation in Kyoto is heating up. And lo and behold, one night, Hiro is awakened by fellow shinobi Kazu, who is working undercover at the shogunate as a clerk. And Kazu tells him that a man named Saburo, who is a cousin of the shogun, has been murdered. And unfortunately, the murder weapon was Kazu's personal dagger, which puts Kazu in a bit of a bind. Hiro, of course, is a bit surprised to see his young friend showing up and asking this question, and more surprised when about 10 minutes later there's a banging on the door and a man has come from the shogun himself to ask Hiro and Father Mateo to come solve this crime as well. Hiro initially, of course, doesn't want to do it because you wouldn't really want to get involved if a friend of yours might have been involved also. But in the passage that I read, they have in fact decided to go to the shogun's palace. They have entered the shogun's palace grounds and gone to the office of Saburo, who has been murdered, and this is the first place where they view the scene of the crime. "Touch nothing in Ashikaga-san's office," Akira said as he led them across the room and into a narrow hall with doors on either side. "His family has not arrived." Hiro stepped back to let Father Mateo lead the way, but not before his sensitive nose caught the mingling odors of documents, jasmine, and blood. The Jesuit entered the room and moved aside, giving Hiro his first clear view of the murder scene. The six-mat room had a built-in desk and cabinet on the southern wall to the right of the entrance. Piles of parchments lay on the desk, some neatly stacked and others spread out as if for examination. A monochromatic landscape scroll adorned the tokonoma, or decorative alcove, on the wall beside the desk. The room was otherwise empty of furniture and adornments. An oblong pool of congealing blood, the size and shape of a fallen man, spread across the center of the room. A trail of bloody spots and streaks led from the pool to an open shoji in the northern wall. Rusty drops and elongated bloody spatters marked the floor and wall to the left of the door. Judging by the size and location of the stains, the killer surprised Saburo in or near that northern entrance. Hiro looked at the blood on the floor. The edges were crisp and linear, with very little smudging. Saburo hadn't moved much after falling. though Hiro felt fairly certain the victim had bled to death on the floor. A single set of bloody footprints led from the pool to a sliding door in the eastern wall of the office. Judging from the natural light that streamed through the paper panels, the door opened onto some kind of garden or courtyard. Father Mateo pointed to the door. Where does that lead? Hiro wished the Jesuit would remember that samurai considered pointing rude. Nowhere, Akira said. That is, it leads outside, but nowhere in particular. There's a veranda and a garden with a path that leads across the grounds. We think that's how the murderer escaped. So it seems. Father Mateo eyed the smudges of rusty blood around the door. Do the tracks continue outside? Akira shook his head. The killer must have removed his tabi. He looked at Hiro. The priest understands the word tabi, socks? Hiro nodded. Were the tabi left behind? Unfortunately, no. Hiro glanced at the desk. The document on top of the pile was a handwritten list of names. Elaborate characters flowed down the page with a rare precision that Hiro recognized as Kazu's. He examined the desk and the floor around it, but saw no sign of blood. As he turned, he noticed something in the bloody pool. He crouched and squinted, trying to identify the object without touching it. What room is that? Father Mateo indicated the open door at the northern end of the room. This time, to Hiro's relief, the priest remembered to gesture like a Japanese. Saburo's private office, Akira said. Hiro returned his attention to the floor. A hairpin lay near the center of the pool of congealing blood. The pin resembled a chopstick with a spray of delicate silver flowers attached to the thicker end. The wood appeared to be lacquered and possibly inlaid, but the blackening blood obscured the finer details. Hiro leaned in for a closer look. Father Mateo joined him. What is that? A kanzashi, Hiro said. A woman's hairpin. Don't touch it, Akira snapped. We're not to move anything before the family arrives. Except the body, Hiro thought. Was Ashikaga-san lying face up or face down? Hiro asked. Who found him here? The lack of a body made it hard to reconstruct the murder scene, though Hiro hadn't really expected to find the corpse in place. Murder dishonored the victim, and leaving Saburo where he fell would embarrass the shogun's clan. A maid discovered the body, Akira said. I didn't see it before it was moved and didn't ask about the position. Didn't the shogun order the scene preserved? Father Mateo looked confused. That wouldn't include the body, Hiro said. Respect for the dead takes precedence. Where did they take him? The Jesuit asked. Hiro gestured toward the opposite side of the room. To his private office. How did you know that? Akira's eyes widened with surprise. A guess, but it seemed the logical place until his family arrives. Hiro stood up. May we see the body? If you wish. Hiro crossed the room, taking care to avoid the rusty drops on the floor. He could only imagine Anna's wrath if he stained his socks with blood. Saburo's inner office also measured 6 mats, large for a clerk of Saburo's rank, but consistent with his relationship to the shogun. A freestanding wooden desk near the eastern wall meant Saburo could face the veranda or the inner door, depending on the weather and his mood. A wooden backrest sat on the far side of the desk, indicating Saburo had faced the inner office the night he died. A bloody tanto lay on the near side of the desk. Dark smears encrusted the dagger's blade and stained the lacquered wooden handle. Even at a distance, Hiro recognized the weapon as a perfect match to Kazu's custom swords. Saburo lay on his back beside the desk with his arms at his sides and his feet toward the door. The front of his torn kimono was drenched in blood, while more blood crusted the right side of his face. His hair had come loose from its samurai knot, presumably during the struggle. The crusty strands clung to his face like leftover noodles inside a dirty bowl. Someone had closed Saburo's eyes, but the gesture didn't do much to improve his appearance. Hiro knelt beside the body to confirm the cause of death. The amount of blood suggested exsanguination, and the tanto appeared to confirm it. The shinobi saw no injuries to Saburo's head or neck, but the 3 wounds in the samurai's chest all could have proven fatal. At least one, and possibly 2, had pierced his heart. A heavy metallic odor rose from the corpse, along with a faint, sickly sweet smell that Hiro recognized as the scent of death. He looked over his shoulder. May I touch him? Akira blanched. Why would you want to? Hiro laid his thumb on Saburo's left cheek. The mottled skin had cooled to match the surrounding air, and the muscles resisted pressure. They felt tense and hard beneath Hiro's thumb. Several hours had passed since the samurai's death. The flesh beneath the bloody side of Saburo's face looked purple, though not very dark, hardly surprising given the copious blood loss. How long do you think he's been dead? Father Mateo asked. Hiro looked up, surprised that the Jesuit guessed correctly what the shinobi was trying to discern. At least 9 hours, maybe more. I'd say he died after dark, but before midnight. You didn't have to touch him, Akira sounded disgusted. We already know he was killed last night. Besides, how does a translator know so much about death? Hiro forced the bitter smile of a ronin. I was not always as I am now. He indicated Saburo's ragged and bloody sleeve. See the slash marks? He fought his killer. Why would a killer strike the arm? Akira asked. Hiro raised his hand to cover his face. Ashikaga-san was protecting himself. Father Mateo pointed to the sheath at Saburo's side. Why didn't he draw his sword? Because he had nothing to grip it with. Hiro reached across the body and raised the corpse's rigid arm. Three of the right-hand fingers were missing. The last one dangled from the hand like a fish on a line, attached by only a paper-thin flap of skin. Father Mateo paled and ran a hand through his hair. How did that happen? Hiro nodded to the desk. I'm guessing the tanto. That is the murder weapon, Akira confirmed. It was lodged in Saburo's back. Father Mateo closed his eyes and looked away. Would you put that arm down, please? Hiro shrugged and laid the arm at Saburo's side. Did someone recover the fingers? Akira nodded. The family will want them for the funeral. Hiro took hold of Saburo's bloody kimono. Let's turn him over. Stop, Akira protested. You shouldn't! But the objection came too late. And if you want to know what Hiro saw when he turned the body over, you will have to keep reading for yourself. This book was really a fun one for me to write, in part because, although I wrote Claws of the Cat first and delved into the world of the tea houses, and I knew that I needed to write that book first in order to introduce the readers to this wonderful, colorful, exotic world, the actual first plot line that came into my head when I considered writing this series was the plot line for Blade of the Samurai, a murder involving a death within the palace of the shogun himself, because the epitome of Japanese culture during the 16th century was really the shogunate. The shogun was the military ruler of Japan. He was distinct from the emperor, who was the titular head of the country, but the shogun really held the reins of power. He controlled the country, and he controlled Kyoto. Much of Japan was still fragmented under the control of warlords, like Lord Oda Nobunaga, who makes a offstage appearance in the first book and a stronger offstage appearance in this one, and is, in fact, in the historical timeline, preparing to march on Kyoto and start a war. So this is a fun series for me because as the books continue, we'll get to go to other areas of Japanese culture. In book three, we'll look at the artisan and brewer's culture, and in book four, we'll be moving into the theater world. So are there any questions? I'd love to answer. Yes. Okay, the question is how I got into this period of history and what sparked my interest. I'm going to repeat the questions for the podcast. I actually fell in love with medieval Japan in 1980 when the Shogun miniseries aired on television. Didn't we all? Richard Chamberlain in the starring role, well, not the starring role, because that would have been, the title role would have been the Shogun, but Richard Chamberlain starring in the miniseries adapted from James Clavell's wonderful novel. I stayed up to watch it late at night and went to the library the day after the miniseries ended, checked out the book, was fascinated with it, and then sort of forgot about Japan until I was getting ready to go to college and discovered that history was more than dates and dead guys. It was actually the story of people's lives and the ability to blend knowledge of Japan with these stories of these lives, the lives of these people who really lived was wonderful. And it just grabbed hold of my heart and my mind, and it never let go. But tell them about the actual moment when I got the idea for the series. I was in 2011, would have been 2011. I was standing in front of the bathroom mirror in March, getting ready for work, and a voice in my head said, "Most ninjas commit murders, but Hiro Hattori solves them," out of the blue. And I stopped, and I looked in the mirror, and I went, "That is a story I have to write." And the story, when I started thinking about it, as I said, I originally actually had the idea of exploring what would happen if a ninja had to actually walk right into the shogun's palace and solve a murder there. But I realized that there was a problem with starting there, which was that it's very difficult for readers to care as much as the writer does about a character that they haven't spent any time with. And the shogun's palace is very formal. It is very rigid. The etiquette is, the rules are very strict. And so I wanted readers to have a chance to get to see Hiro and Father Mateo in a more colorful world to begin with. So I wrote the first book set in the tea house culture. And then we move to the slightly starker world of the Shogun's palace, although it's still very exotic and dangerous. It's simply a different perspective on things. Yes?
What else is a pit? Were you working on other things when that statement or that sentence came to you?
Was I working on other things when that idea came to me, or did it just sort of come out of the blue? I had actually just finished the draft of a pure novel of historical fiction, which probably will never be published at this point, but, you know, one never says never. But I don't have any plans for it, because once I realized that mystery was really my niche, I've never looked back. I had finished a historical novel. I was trying to figure out what to write next. This idea came to me, and I just thought, ooh, I really could write mystery. And once I started writing mysteries, I just realized it mysteries just make my heart sing. Read them, write them. I just absolutely love them. So I wasn't actually working. I was looking for a new project, and the project found me. Yes. Do I ever use animals in my books? And if so, how? I love animals in fiction. Animals are wonderful in fiction, both because I love animals and also because they teach us things about people. If you notice, animals like people unless those people are mean to animals. And so animals in fiction can be a really great character because they can add a lot to the story. There are actually two animals that make featured appearances in Blade of the Samurai. One is Hiro's cat, whose name is Gato, who we met in book one. And she does, in fact, have a great little scene or two in Blade of the Samurai. She's a great character who doesn't ever let me forget about her for long, which is what cats are good for if you have them. And she is actually based on my own cat, whose name is Bumblebee, but we call her Ubi, who is a tortoiseshell. And so that's what Hiro has. And there is also an Akita, a hunting dog, that makes an appearance in this book, which belongs to the woodcutter who lives across the street from Father Mateo. And that dog actually plays a pivotal role in this book, but I will not say anything more about that so that I don't spoil the surprise. Yes?
Ninjas or shinobi are a very secretive society, so how do you find out about them?
Ninjas or shinobi were a very secretive society, so how do you find out about them? Fortunately, there's great truth to the rumor that two people can keep a secret only if one of them is dead. And so over the years, there's been quite a bit of information that has come to light. I do work with a tour guide and historian in Kyoto who has helped me obtain maps and layouts of houses and a lot of the information that I need to get the details right. So all of the houses that appear in the novel are actually based on houses that still exist from the 16th century. So all of the landscaping is correct. I will mention for the podcast and for the people here that there is actually a map and a glossary. I'll point out, a lot of people have mentioned they don't know there's a glossary till the end, but there is a map of the Shogun's palace in this novel. The map is keys into all of the key places in the Shogun's palace where events happen in the book. And there's kind of a little unique story about the map, which is that with help of my friend in Kyoto, I was able to locate the exact location of the Shogun's palace in 1565. The Shogun's palaces were built of wood, and Kyoto suffers many earthquakes and fires. And the Shogun's palace actually burned three times during the 16th century. And every time they burned it, they would simply move it a short distance away and rebuild because, you know, why bother cleaning up if you can just find a new spot, right? Especially if there are a bunch of people who don't have a lot of money that you can just sort of clear them out, knock their houses down, and build what you want. So we were able to locate the exact correct spot, and the location in the book is correct. However, we had trouble locating an accurate map because the Shogun's palace was a military installation. And you didn't want a lot of maps of your military installation getting out, so it was very hard to find accurate maps from that era of exactly what it looked like. So as a little bit of a treat to readers, what I did was I based the Shogun's palace in 1565 off of the historical notes that exist and also off of the map of the existing Shogun's palace, which is called Nijo Castle, which was built by Tokugawa Ieyasu in the start of the 17th century. And if you go to Kyoto today and you tour Nijo Castle, you will walk through rooms where the events in this book took place. And I did that because since we couldn't find the exact map that would have existed. I felt it was better to allow the readers to walk Hiro's footsteps in the modern day. So that was the little story about the map. Yes?
Following on the heels of that, where do you do your research for the tea houses and the lifestyles and the way that people are?
Where do I do my research for the tea houses and the lifestyles and the way that people are? Three different places. I read a lot of books. There are actually remarkably detailed books on life in medieval Japan. I have a wonderful book on, it's called The Brewers and Moneylenders of Medieval Japan, and it's about 400 pages, and it's about just that topic just during the 16th century. And so that was one of my primary source topics for the third book. And then I do a lot of work on the internet, which, you know, if everything on the internet is true, right? But usually if you can confirm it with three or four sources, you know you're in the right area. And then I also work with Tomoko Yoshihara, who lives in Kyoto and helps me with my research there by, as I said, providing maps and helping me with translations and things like that. So that's been a real boon to be able to have eyes on the ground and actually have sort of a research annex that I can access when I need to. It's a great resource. And then I just do a lot of reading, a lot of study. One of my undergraduate areas was Japanese architecture, so I love that too.
How did you connect to the woman in Kyoto?
How did I connect to the woman in Kyoto? I was actually trying to find a map of a temple called Tofukuji for the first book, which is a very famous temple, has a lot of landmarks, and I knew I needed the characters to walk through the temple grounds. And while I was Googling Tofukuji Temple and maps and walking tours, I came across a site called KyotoFreeGuide.com. And Tomoko is one of the English-speaking guides who works at KyotoFreeGuide.com. I emailed her, I asked her a question, and she and I have been connected ever since. And she is a wonderful person. Yes?
Have you traveled there to walk in your character's footsteps?
Have I traveled there to walk in my character's footsteps? I have not actually walked his footsteps from these novels. I have had to have Tomoko do that for me in these. But I actually have a research trip planned for next spring because I'm going to be researching the next several novels in the series. And my son will be there studying in Japan at that time. And we also have plans to backpack the Tokaido Road from Kyoto to Edo next spring. So, yes?
You mentioned, you see your genre as mystery, but looking at your, reading the book and the tone of it, sounds like a detective story, but you're moving away from the detective story genre or intermingle?
The question is, my genre, I state my genre as mystery, but when reading the book, it seems like a detective story. At this point, I would call it both. I think it is. I think mystery really does include and incorporate detectives. I would call Agatha Christie a mystery writer. If you like it as a detective story, please. If you want to read it as a detective story, absolutely. I definitely think it is a detective, a whodunit. I think it's a police procedural sort of, in a way, because you've got a detective who's following a process to find a killer. So I think it's both. I think it's fair to call it both. Absolutely. Do we have any other questions, or are we? Yes, one more question. Yes.
Since you mentioned the tea house or the geisha, the courtesan of the palace, are you going to revisit that or review that? Because, you know, to be blunt, this is a pretty male-oriented story. You know, samurai, ninja,
yes. The question is, am I going to revisit the women, the courtesans in the palace or the other women in the culture? Because this is a very this story is very male dominated. Yes. I have tried to actually create quite a bit of balance in the series. The first book was heavily female dominated because it takes place in the tea house culture where women largely ran the show. This one was a move to a conscious move to a more male dominated area. And yes, you will see more women in the third book in the series. There are women of the samurai class, women of the artisan class, and women of the beggar class who are all represented in the third book. So I try really hard to sort of go back and forth. The society was largely male-dominated, but I look very hard for the niches where women were able to shine, and I love to let them shine in my books. Thank you to everybody for coming out tonight. I really appreciate it. Thank you for your questions and for coming to support me.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fode, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks as we podcast Authors on Tour.